It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new KFF Health News report focuses on a Wisconsin woman who was wrongfully denied insurance coverage for a life-saving abortion.
Using her middle name only, Ashley told KFF she had a condition called pre-viable PPROM. That's when the water breaks before the pregnancy reaches viability. The condition can create severe complications like infection, sepsis, and death.
Even though Ashley needed an abortion to save her life, she went through multiple appeals with her insurance company.
Every time I call insurance about my bill, I was like sobbing on the phone because it was so frustrating to have to like explain the situation and like why I even think it should be covered.
The report, which ran on NPR, shows how insurance coverage can be confusing and complex in abortion procedures.
Jenny Higgins researches abortion access as a professor of obstetrics and gynecology and director of the Collaborative for Reproductive Equity at UW-Madison. Jenny, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Let's pick up Ashley's story. The KFF Health News piece, Dr. Elizabeth Bennett, Ashley's doctor and clinical advisor for your organization, your collaborative. Why did Ashley need an abortion?
Yeah, I appreciate you focusing on Ashley's case. And I, of course, defer to my clinical colleagues like Dr. Bennett to talk more about the specifics of the clinical aspects of this case. Mm-hmm. But pre-prom, this issue that Ashley reported, is when the amniotic sac, when your membranes rupture early on in pregnancy, and it leads to an immediate not only demise of the pregnancy, but potential threat to the pregnant person because of a risk of infection and sepsis. So even though it's not an immediately life-threatening situation, it could be. And that is what Dr. Bennett and her colleagues were trying to respond to when Ashley reported to them for care.
What can we learn from Ashley's story here? Why was coverage initially denied?
Yeah, there's so much we can learn here and from other cases of people having trouble getting coverage for abortion care. So Ashley as a federal employee had federal insurance for her case, from what I understand. And as you and your listeners may be familiar, while Roe v. Wade passed in 1973 and legalized the federal right to abortion, in 1976, a representative from Illinois named Henry Hyde was able to put an appropriations bill in that prevented any federal funds from being used for the provision of abortion care. So this is called the Hyde Amendment. And so the Hyde Amendment prohibits any federal funds, including Medicaid funds, from being used to provide abortion care, except in certain cases, such as a reported rape or incest where there is a police report or risk to maternal life or grave risk to maternal health. So even though Ashley's case did constitute a grave risk to her health, because of billing codes and because of other challenges, the insurance company at first blush just said, no, we don't cover abortion, so we're not covering yours. So it took Ashley multiple attempts and very, very, I think, traumatic phone calls and other things to try to sort out the care she was actually deserving through her health insurance.
It's confusing to me because there is medical codes for so many nuances of conditions in healthcare. I'm wondering, does the Hyde Amendment affect how we see the nuances of abortion coverage? What are the ripple effects of the Hyde Amendment, you know, decades since it became part of the landscape here?
Yeah, the Hyde Amendment has had profound impact on not only people's access to abortion care and coverage, but the way we think of it. So while Ashley's case is incredibly compelling and important, and any individual's case is important, the majority of people who need abortion care don't seek abortion care for medical reasons, but because often for financial reasons, right? People most likely to experience unwanted pregnancy and who are most in need of financial assistance for abortion services to begin with, are then the ones most affected by the Hyde Amendment because they can't, you know, while Medicaid, let's take Badger Care here in Wisconsin, which is our state form of Medicaid. Mm-hmm. While Badger Care will cover prenatal costs and birthing care costs, it doesn't cover abortion care costs. And I think the Hyde Amendment culturally affected our thinking around abortion not being basic health care, somehow treating it exceptionally or differently than other forms of health care. When the American Public Health Association, the American Medical Association, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists all say that abortion is a form of basic health care, reproductive health care that folks need and deserve access to. So Hyde has had a profound impact on people, not only are thinking about abortion, but people's ability to get desired care.
We're talking about insurance coverage for abortion procedures in Wisconsin and beyond. Jenny Higgins is here, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison and director of its Collaborative for Reproductive Equity. Jenny, let's look a little bit deeper on the economic situation. I mean, you cite in your research more abortion seekers in the U.S. live on low incomes. About half live below the federal poverty level. What are the effects of earnings on abortion procedures?
Right. So let's just, I think sometimes it's useful to put an actual number when we're talking about federal poverty level. What does that even mean? Sometimes a hard concept for us to get our heads around. Mm-hmm. So for a single, let's think of a single parent, right? We know that most people who seek abortions in the US already have at least one child. So let's take a single parent. That is someone who lives below $21,000 a year to support herself and her child. So half of abortion seekers in the U.S. live below that line, and about three quarters live just a little bit above that line or lower. And there are multiple ways that poverty and abortion restrictions are associated, right? So as I mentioned, many people report considering abortion due to their limited financial resources, right? So many folks feel as if they would love to carry pregnancy to term and raise a child, but they're not in a financial situation to do that. So they consider abortion. However, those are the folks who are most likely to be Medicaid recipients or to be uninsured. And so then they're faced with an out-of-pocket expense that they might not be able to take on, right? Mm. We know in the U.S., close to 40% of people say they couldn't afford an unexpected $400 expense, right? And abortion care, while remarkably affordable compared to many outpatient procedures, is about $500 to $1,000 plus childcare costs or travel costs, lodging costs, right? Especially for folks who have to travel to care. And so the very people who be most in need of abortion services are the least likely to be able to come up with the expenses. And then the final piece of this relationship between poverty and abortion is that for those living on low incomes to begin with, being unable to obtain an abortion and going on to have a child will likely compound their financial challenges. So we see these really difficult cycles that abortion restrictions, including the Hyde Amendment, exert on socially disadvantaged folks, especially people living on low incomes.
And tying this to your research, you've been compiling interviews with women who were seeking abortions after the Supreme Court overturned Roe in June of 2022. What are you learning from their personal stories?
Yeah, gosh, these interviews are complex and wonderful. I mean, it's such an honor to talk to folks in Wisconsin who have been pregnant after Dobbs and who are navigating how to find care. And we definitely have run into folks who, because of their financial challenges, are back-ended into carrying pregnancies to term that they otherwise would not have, right? So I'll just tell you one story of this woman who we've called Laura. Laura is a pseudonym. Laura is a white woman in her late 20s. She grew up in small town Wisconsin. And while she had attended some college, she had fallen on hard times. So at the time we connected with her for our research, she and her partner had been living out of her car, but they had gotten into a car accident, which had led them to be looking for longer term housing. But they were at the moment living in and out of shelters and hotels. When she found out she was pregnant, she immediately wanted an abortion. However, she was really faced with how do I raise the funds to get this, especially since at that time she had to travel out of state
to get
care.
She's trying to get to Chicago. Yeah.
Right. She's trying to get to Chicago. And so to be able to find the money for the procedure, someone to drive her or get her or a bus ride to that clinic and potential lodging costs, she just couldn't do it. And so at the time we connected with her, she was in her third trimester and trying to prepare to become a parent, but just hadn't figured out yet how to make that happen. So I think cases like Laura's really show us that the Hyde Amendment and other insurance obstacles to abortion care really back end people in our country into having pregnancies and births that they would not have otherwise, which is, I think, a threat to their human rights and their dignity.
Even before the Dobbs decision, insurance coverage for abortion procedures varied a lot. In our final moments together, what is your outlook for insurers and how they will treat abortion and procedures in the future?
Yeah, I think that the Dobbs decision has put the right to abortion much, much more centrally back into political discourse, right? So many politicians are coming out in support of abortion rights who might not have been prior to the Dobbs decision. What I'd like to see more of is politicians also taking on Hyde and the Hyde Amendment, right? So until we allow for Medicaid coverage for this basic healthcare cost, especially if we're covering prenatal and birthing care costs, until we do that, abortion will continue to be an economic injustice issue, and that the folks living on the lowest incomes will be unable to afford this service. So I'm really hoping that we'll see more of a cultural shift into talking about Hyde right alongside talking about Roe v. Wade.
Jenny, thanks for joining us. Jenny Higgins, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, dig into a tenured faculty layoff at UW-Milwaukee and the changes that led to a difficult budget situation.
I think that we have shifted in the last 10 or 15 years from a state that deeply valued the UW system and its campuses to a state where many of our leaders try to disavow us on a daily basis.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The UW Board of Regents recently passed a plan to eliminate UW-Milwaukee's College of General Studies, citing financial pressures. The college was formed when UW-Milwaukee integrated the Waukesha and Washington County branch campuses in 2018.
The closure means layoffs for almost three dozen tenured faculty. That's a first-of-its-kind move for the system. Since tenure protections were changed almost 10 years ago, only one tenured faculty member has been removed under the policy change.
Kathleen Dolan is a distinguished professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee and elected chair of the UW-Milwaukee Faculty Senate, which voted on the plan when it was proposed early this month. Kathy, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Sure. Happy to be here.
Well, this is the first big layoff of tenured faculty in the UW system since the tenure protections changed about a little over around a decade ago. Can you give a sense of the mood among faculty members at UW-Milwaukee as this new school year kicks off after these big cuts were approved?
Well, you know, I would say that no one is happy about what happened last week. No one wanted to get to that point. I think what faculty here feel as much as anything else, besides sympathy for our College of General Studies colleagues, of course, is that faculty were put in a pretty difficult position by a series of things that have occurred in our state over the last 9 or 10 years, one of which you referred to in the 2015-2016 changes to tenure and changes to the sort of role of faculty on the UW campuses. But it is also, you know, the current situation is also exacerbated by the 10 years of tuition freeze that we experienced, the sort of pretty dramatic underfunding of the UW system, to which President Rothman refers repeatedly, you know, how we sit at 43rd in the nation in funding our system. And, you know, so we've got financial difficulties, financial realities, we've got enrollment challenges, and all of those things, you know, sort of came to a head in this situation.
And you've said elsewhere you don't love this decision, but given the circumstances you outlined, in effect, this was the best of other bad options. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So when the two-year campuses were attached to four-year campuses back in 2018, I think the hope at that point from then System President Ray Cross was that attaching the two-year schools to the four-year schools would give the two-year schools some financial stability, perhaps some assistance with enrollment problems, because it is important to note that the two-year UW campuses have been experiencing enrollment declines for years, and certainly before they were attached to four-year campuses. But the funding from the state, you know, wasn't necessarily as robust as it could have been. Enrollment declines continued. There appeared to be a real softening in the state among students wanting a two-year degree or a place to start a four-year degree. And we had a situation by the time President Rothman had ordered us to close both the Washington County and then the Waukesha campuses. We have, you know, very clear evidence that the enrollment at those two-year campuses had declined 65% over the last 10 or 12 years. And along with that was not an accompanying decrease in the instructional staff. So we were left with a situation back in March, you know, when Waukesha was closed, where we had 46 faculty who were attached to the College of General Studies. And given the price point of tuition at the two-year schools, which is half of that of the four-year schools, and given the precipitous enrollment declines, the College of General Studies and those two campuses just, you know, became financially non-viable. And then, you know, the same situation exists on the four-year campuses. I mean, we know that there are four-year campuses in the UW system who are in pretty significant financial and enrollment difficulties. And the ability of our UWM main campus to absorb, you know, a large number of additional faculty when we have been undergoing budget cuts here and haven't hired many faculty here in many years, you know, just wasn't possible.
Do you worry about a potential precedent here with this larger layoff of tenured faculty if in a few years, well, maybe a department needs to go, English or political science or something like that, is judged to be no longer of interest, that faculty who are at UW-Milwaukee or other institutions now could be facing a similar situation in the future?
The possibility always existed, even before last Thursday, because it is the changes in tenure and in the policies at the Board of Regents back in 2015 and 2016 that allowed Thursday to happen. What we're seeing now is the fruit, you know, coming to bear of all of the underfunding of the campuses. So again, the tuition freeze and the underfunding doesn't help. Do I worry that this will happen again? Yes, of course I do. I worry that enrollment declines will continue. We are seeing in the state of Wisconsin, among the high school students who go to college, fewer of them are going to UW campuses than they used to. So we have a double-edged problem here. One is that there are fewer high school students projected to be in Wisconsin. And then at the UW system, we're seeing fewer of those college-going students coming to UW campuses. So the campus is challenged and the system is challenged. And it might be the case where we have, you know, precipitous declines in some fields. But I think if the political science department saw a 65% decline in its enrollments over a 10 or 15 year period, people would rightly ask, if you've had 65% decline in your enrollments, do you need all 16 of your faculty? And I I don't love that idea and I don't love that argument, but we are no different as faculty in some ways than any other set of employees. And we lose sight of the 60 staff and other employees at Waukesha and Washington County that lost their jobs already because they don't have tenure protections. So we live in a market economy and we live in a capitalist society where when there is not demand for certain work, businesses lay people off. And this is the first time that has happened to faculty. But quite honestly, while I understand all of the importance of tenure, I'm not sure that faculty are different or special or better than people in other categories of employment.
Do you see a way to maybe sell the UW system to Wisconsin students to get to raise that percentage back up to where more of those college-bound Wisconsin people, like kids and grownups, I guess, consider UW system schools?
Well, I think there are a couple of different approaches we could take. I think that the conversation in the state and in the state legislature, particularly about the UW system, has not been friendly to creating a positive atmosphere in the minds of some Wisconsin residents toward us. I think that we have shifted in the last 10 or 15 years from a state that deeply valued the UW system and its campuses to a state where many of our leaders try to disavow us on a daily basis. And so I think that if our political and social and cultural climates in the state could change so that people would be more open to understanding the value that UW campuses bring and not reflexively falling back on political arguments, I think that could help turn things around. You know, the 13 four-year schools in the UW system provide an excellent high-quality education to every student. And there's no reason that fewer Wisconsin residents should be attending campuses. I think the other thing that's an important piece is that there are more than 700,000 adults in Wisconsin who have some college education but do not have a degree. And I think that part of, you know, economic renewal and individual level opportunity is for the UW system to find ways to be a place where more adults could finish a degree and perhaps move on in their own individual careers as they move forward. So I think there are ways that we can reconnect to the state and its residents. And I think that starts with having a board of regents and a system president and a legislature that value us and can make that argument to the public.
We'll leave it there. Kathy, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
That was Kathleen Dolan, distinguished professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee and elected chair of the UW-Milwaukee Faculty Senate. Nicholas Fleischer is with us now for another perspective on the tenured faculty layoffs. He's an associate professor of linguistics at UW-Milwaukee and president of the Wisconsin Conference of the American Association of University Professors. Nicholas, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've raised concerns about the layoffs, including that you say other avenues weren't explored as well as they could have been. What kind of things do you have in mind?
Yeah, so this is something that's been raised by a number of the affected faculty in the College of General Studies and also by members of the Faculty Senate at UWM. So other avenues would include various kinds of positions on the main campus in Milwaukee at UWM that might be available, and also staffing some of the programs that are going to be coming from the College of General Studies into the main campus. And so those are, you know, what many of the CGS faculty who are affected have said is that, you know, there may well be some plausible opportunities there. Moreover, the university is required by state law to explore to the best of their abilities, finding those kinds of opportunities for laid off faculty. And so the concern is that the university has kind of not fulfilled its duty on that score.
As we've heard, there was this rule change in tenure, this law change. This is the first time we've really seen it take effect, apart from one professor in one case since then. Are you worried now that this layoff of a few dozen tenured faculty sets a precedent for future financial crunches at UW-Milwaukee and elsewhere in the system?
Yeah, that is a major concern. So it's the first time we've seen something like this in Wisconsin. It's not the first time that something like this has happened nationally. In the last couple of years, there have been a number of high-profile cases One, you know, very concerning one was at West Virginia University, which is a flagship campus that closed a bunch of programs and laid off a large number of tenured faculty there. But it's the first time we've seen something like this in Wisconsin. It's the first major use of this new policy that was changed back in 2015, 2016. And so, yes, in an environment where the budget for the UW system and for individual campuses, especially outside of Madison, budget situations are still very dire at most campuses, certainly including Milwaukee, there's a real concern that these kinds of, you know, budget-driven program reductions and layoffs could happen again.
Are you and your colleagues at UW-Milwaukee who aren't affected by this layoff concerned, worried that your department could be next?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a major worry for people. You know, there's any number of departments that are small that could be vulnerable. And just in general, the concern is that, you know, this kind of layoff through program closure is something that, you know, according to national standards that are put out by the American Association of University Professors, the AAUP, which is the kind of, you know, standard, you know, major standards organization and advocacy organization in this area in the United States, these kinds of program closures are supposed to be done for educational reasons, right? So if there's a program whose kind of educational time has passed, or, you know, that's been kind of superseded by new developments, you know, in that field, then, you know, that might be the kind of situation where a program could be closed down and faculty could be let go because of that. But what we're seeing now is program closures that are really strongly tied to budget reasons, and where there's almost no pretense at all that there's a good educational reason for closing down the program. And that's a major concern.
The argument is, though, that economic realities really do face universities. Enrollment might go down, state support might go down, and costs go up. The economic reality is sometimes there have to be cuts, and maybe tenure shouldn't be a force field against those cuts if there's really this fundamental economic need for that change. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a danger of viewing the economic situation of the universities as a kind of force of nature rather than as the consequence of a set of particular political choices, right? Wisconsin currently has the largest budget surplus it's ever had. Nonetheless, the state support to the university system has really stagnated. Outside of UW-Madison, things are very dire. Madison has all kinds of revenue streams that the other campuses in the system do not. And so they have been relatively insulated from these kinds of budget problems. But yeah, I would say that these kinds of budget challenges are tied to the specific political choices we've made about how to fund public higher ed. And those are choices that could be made differently and that could be changed if there was the political will to do so.
You had called at some points for UW-Milwaukee's chancellor to reconsider this proposal. Well, now it's gone through the regents. Do you have any hope that there could be yet another look at this that could come up with a different outcome?
So I think the institutional channels for doing that have run their course, you know, both at UW-Milwaukee and at the Board of Regents. But there are some external channels that I think the affected faculty are going to pursue. And those include making an appeal to the American Association of University Professors, right, the national office of the AAUP, which, you know, may be asked to open an academic freedom and tenure investigation on the basis of this case. And there may be some legal remedies that affected faculty may pursue as well on the basis of those reappointment rights that exist for them in state law.
I talked to one of your colleagues earlier who said, in effect, not wild about this decision, but given the realities of funding from the legislature, it might be the best of bad options. But I think you and many of your colleagues, whatever you think of this decision, agree on what you were saying earlier, that you'd like to see more support from the state legislature so you don't face situations like this. How would you make that case to the public, to state lawmakers, that they might want to revisit the budget, look at the request for an increase from the UW Board of Regents?
Sure. So, you know, to me, this all goes back to the Wisconsin idea, right? This idea that the university system is supposed to bring the benefits of higher education, you know, public higher education and university research and teaching to everyone in the state. And the Wisconsin idea is very much about bringing that to people where they are. And I think the thing that should really concern people in Wisconsin is that we have seen a kind of retreat from that commitment. You've seen in the news over the last few years that a number of the two-year campuses of the former UW colleges have been shut down all around the state. And we hear this from legislators. Sometimes we even hear it from members of the Board of Regents that there's concern about program duplication, right? So do we need to have a political science program in Eau Claire and also in Green Bay? Or do we need to, you know, can campuses specialize? That kind of discussion, it makes sense from a kind of, you know, business efficiency standpoint. It does not make sense from an educational standpoint, because the point of the public higher education system is to bring those things to people where they are. And that has been the historical strength of the UW system. And that is what we are unfortunately, and to my mind, very concerningly retreating from right now under our current legislative leadership and board leadership in the system.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nicholas Fleischer is an associate professor of linguistics at UW-Milwaukee, president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Association of University Professors. Earlier, we spoke with Kathleen Dolan, distinguished professor of political science at UW-Milwaukee and the elected chair of the UW-Milwaukee Faculty Senate.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, we talk with a pair of principals in the De Pere School District about how they use certified therapy dogs during the school day.
If there are any, you know, escalated emotions or big emotions, as we call them here at school, Charlie helps de-escalate that.
The life of a chocolate lab named Charlie on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As students and teachers in De Pere head back to class, they may find a certified therapy dog eager to greet them at the school entrance.
In 2021, the district brought in a chocolate lab named Charlie, who is based at Dickinson Elementary. Since then, the district has added a therapy dog to all of its elementary schools.
Now, a Bernedoodle named Oakley is in training for a future alongside fifth and sixth graders.
Two principals in the Unified School District of De Pere are leading efforts to incorporate therapy dogs into their schools.
Andy Bradford is the principal at Foxview Intermediate School, which will be the future home for Oakley. Andy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we have Luke Herlash, who is the principal at Dickinson Elementary School in the De Pere District. Luke, welcome.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Luke, starting with you, with all three of the elementary schools now in the De Pere District having these certified therapy dogs, Dickinson Elementary, Charlie, having been hard at work now for a few years, can you walk us through what a day is like for Charlie?
Would be happy to do so. Yes. Yeah. So Charlie starts her morning at her home provider's home, wakes up, gets a little workout in, a little fetch, a little breakfast, bathroom break, and then she heads to school with fourth grade teacher, Miss Lanessa Klahach. So Lanessa is her home provider. They get here and they actually greet a few of our students that typically would otherwise struggle in the morning, either with anxiety, nerves, wanting to come to school, those sorts of things. So a little bit of a soft start for a couple of our kiddos, and they very much eagerly await Charlie's arrival to school. And so they will help her get settled in for the day. They'll read her a few stories. They'll bring her out for another little round of fetch, which she certainly loves. And it gives those kids some leadership opportunities as well. Once school is started, she's handed off to her primary handler. Her handler here typically is our counselor, Mrs. Brandy Knott. And so Mrs. Knott will teach some classes of life skills, teaching different social emotional lessons to classes of kids. And so for that, Charlie will just hang out with the class. She might be on her place for a portion of the instruction. When kids are breaking off into small groups, she might be roaming around and saying hi to kids. Sometimes Mrs. Knott will have some students read to her in that space as well. But a majority of the day, Charlie's also with Mrs. Knott when she's providing small group counseling or individual counseling to students. If there are any, escalated emotions or big emotions, as we call them here at school, Charlie helps de-escalate that. So either myself, Mrs. Knott, or our Dean of Students, Ms. Amber Breyer, often will also handle Charlie and bring her into situations that students just need a little bit of time to calm down, relax, and regain a regulated state. So she spends a lot of time throughout the day doing that. She does get a little tired, so she does take a bathroom break midday, a little bit of rest time, and then she's working again for the afternoon. And then after that, she's just a dog. After school, she is more of a pet, and she knows that is the case when she takes her vest off, and she knows her day of work is done, and then she acts like a typical dog.
She has a very full day, it sounds like. Can you describe what she looks like, the kind of dog she is?
Oh, absolutely. She's beautiful. She is a chocolate lab. She's on the smaller side. I don't know exactly, but I would guess 55 to 60 pounds. She's very healthy. She's very lean. She loves to run and fetch and play all day when she's allowed to do so.
So, Andy, you're in the process of preparing a therapy dog for your intermediate school. What does that process look like? Where are you at with it?
Yeah, that's correct. So we were fortunate to receive funding through our district. We have a community event each year called the Redbird Rally, and the funds from that help support our therapy dogs. And so we were next in line and thrilled to be able to begin the process. So that started with identifying a home provider that would be a staff person that would, as Luke described, have the dog that spends, the nights and weekends and summers, with the family. And so we did that. So we have Mrs. Megan Damhauser, who's a teacher here at Foxview, and she and her family agreed to be the home provider. And so from there, we identified a trainer to help us through the process that Luke and the other folks in our elementary schools that have gone through this helped us do. And so from there, we identified a breed that was desirable for Megan's family and also conducive to be a therapy dog. And so they settled on a Bernedoodle, identified a breeder, and were able to secure a dog. And that dog, his name is Oakley. And so Megan and her family went to Missouri to pick the dog up in June and really immediately started the process. So enrolled in the typical puppy class that young dogs would do as they join a family. Learning commands, and then just really becoming desensitized to all of the smells and sounds and all of the things that Oakley would expect to see and experience at school. So that's being around a lot of kids in the summer. It's coming to school occasionally. And now as school is just getting ready to begin, Oakley will spend limited time here leashed, not operating as a therapy dog, but of course, getting more familiar with the surroundings. And so, he is learning his commands and, doing a great job.
Luke, from what I understand, there isn't a large body of research to indicate that therapy dogs are improving students, mental health, their well-being. And I'm wondering, as you go along in these years, what research or data are you collecting or what are you trying to observe?
There is some research out there, and we collected some at the outset of this program that we presented to our school board, suggesting that therapy dogs have positive impacts on all humans, whether that's students or staff. But they did charge us with collecting some data. So the first 2 to 3 months of Charlie's deployment, we had tracked every single one of her deployments, and we had a spreadsheet that tracked using the zones of regulation, which is a 4-point scale, when a student was dysregulated or escalated in their emotional status, how long it took for Charlie to get that student to a more regulated state. And on average, it was between 10 to 15 minutes per deployment that that student was back on track and ready to return to the you know, regular routines of the school day or the regular you know, classroom environment and things like that. So we tracked that for a few months, presented that data to the school board and actually to a few other districts that we've been collaborating with as well that are interested in partnering or starting their own programs. And so, yeah, we've definitely seen a more efficient de-escalation for our students on average.
We're talking with a pair of principals in the Unified School District of De Pere about how therapy dogs are being used in the district. Luke Herlash is principal at Dickinson Elementary School. That's the first school in De Pere to have a district-owned therapy dog. And Andy Bradford is principal at Foxview Intermediate School, currently in the process of preparing Oakley for their school. So, Luke, as you work with the district on this, you work with other districts, what reception, what are you hearing as you move along in this process and Charlie becomes more of a fixture in your school?
Absolutely. It's been a process, and I'd say we're at the point where, you know, the community and other communities are very receiving and excited to receive Charlie or other therapy dogs into their school environments. There was a little bit of maybe trepidation at the outset. We had to, you know, push for this and convince folks at the outset of launching this program a few years ago. For a couple of years, we had to, you know, find some more research and gather more evidence. And it really started when I was teaching third grade over at Heritage Elementary School. One of my third grade colleagues, Mrs. Mary Luke, and her husband, Tim, did a ton of dog training, more for show than therapeutic reasons. But the response of students when they brought their trained dogs in was just so simply incredible that we knew that we had to do something. So that was kind of the outset of it. And it took time, a few years, to kind of convince people that this was something that we should turn into a district-owned program. But we've done that. And I'd say that there's actually quite a bit of excitement from school officials, other districts, and certainly the community at large.
Andy, can you weigh in on the investment here, the cost or the ongoing cost for a therapy dog, the training, cost of care? What would it be like for a district?
Yeah, so I mean, you obviously have the initial costs of purchasing a dog, and then, you know, the training aspect is crucial. So you want to do that right, and we've partnered with a really good trainer. And so, you know, those ongoing costs, as Luke mentioned, you know, the grooming, the vet care, all of that. So you're probably in the neighborhood of somewhere between like a $7,000 to $10,000 investment, you know, when it's all said and done. I think that for us, it's the investment in our children and being able to provide something that, as Luke, you know, indicated earlier, can really help quickly bring students back to a calm state and one that can then be conducive for their learning, which of course we want time in the classroom and optimizing that opportunity for kids. And any tool that we have in our toolbox that we can utilize, I think, you know, it makes perfect sense.
Do you think, Andy, there will be any differences with how Oakley would interact with older students versus the elementary level?
You know, I think as far as the age of kids, I don't think that that necessarily is as big of a factor. We've seen really, you know, benefits for therapy dogs in other therapeutic environments. I shared with some others that my grandfather's 100 years old. He lives in an assisted living facility, and Thursdays is therapy dog day, and there's a number of therapy dogs that come in and spend time there. And I mean, he speaks very highly of it and loves it. So I don't think age is a factor when it comes to this.
Luke, what do you do about students who are perhaps allergic to dogs or have a fear or aversion to dogs?
Yeah, great question. That's something we had to put a lot of thought and effort into on the front end. And so we developed a therapy dog opt-out letter that we send out in the fall of every school year. We usually get about 5 or so students on an annual basis that are opting out for some reason. And we always have somebody from student services reach out to those families to try to better understand the opt-out And yes, there's been some aversions to dogs and things like that. So we've actually developed some training videos where we have students showing how to approach Charlie, teaching about how to greet dogs in general, you know, some safe protocols around that. And so that's helped students that maybe have not had interactions with dogs in the past. And so we would never, you know, push kids into that, but we try to gradually release them and show them that it can be a comfortable experience. And so, you know, the kids mostly have said, yes, I'm gonna try this. And there's been a few kids that just said, no, that's not for me. And that's 100% okay.
I wonder, Luke, where do you think this is headed? What does success look like with therapy dogs for schools in the future? We know that students in Wisconsin are grappling with mental health issues, and those resources may not be there.
Yeah, great question. Obviously, you know, on the outset of this, we were really focused on what can we do for our kids. And certainly that's going to be always in the forefront of our thought. But certainly we are happy and excited to collaborate with others around the state or the region. We've certainly worked with a few districts off the top of my head. We've worked with Wausau, Hilbert, Mount Horeb. And I know our director of student services, Jerry Nicholson, has worked with other student services director and WCAS, a state organization. So I'm sure the list is longer, but I know that we've certainly worked with a few of those districts to help them launch their own programs and understand, you know, the contractual side of it. It's a very, you know, cute program on the public-facing side of things, and the kids love it. And there's a lot of really nice, you know, storylines to it. But certainly there is kind of that legal background side of it, too, that you have to put yourselves in good positions. And things like that. You have to make sure all the certifications are in order, the training is in order, the contract with the home provider is in order, and things like that. So we've helped districts understand how they can go ahead and set that up so everybody is a winner in this program.
I wonder, Andy, at the end of the day, what outcomes do you hope for in the future incorporating a therapy dog in your school?
I think for us, our main goal is to, you know, just add value to our culture with having Oakley here. And whether that's students, whether that's staff, whether that's community, you know, we see a lot of benefit that's been demonstrated at the elementary level, and we're excited to continue that momentum. And I think that that's really the biggest thing, is that impact that, you know, it has positively on students and, you know, can lead to those outcomes that we desire.
Andy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Luke, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Luke Herlash is the principal of Dickinson Elementary School, home to Charlie, and Andy Bradford is the principal at Foxview Intermediate School, where Oakley is preparing to be based. And they're in the Unified School District of De Pere. They joined us to talk about their efforts to introduce district-owned therapy dogs to their schools and how it's helping their students. And we can continue the conversation about therapy dogs and their impact on your life. Reach out to us with your story. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Communities around the country are trying to slow down cars, especially in places where there are lots of people walking, and they're trying to cut back on reckless driving.
Milwaukee is in the midst of a long-term traffic calming project, and city officials say it's showing some signs of improvement. We'll find out what kind of things make a difference in slowing down drivers in a conversation tomorrow on the show.
And we want to hear from you now. Do you think speeding and reckless driving are problems in your community? Have you seen some kind of changes that have actually made things better, safer? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can also call or text us. 888-642-0232 is the number. Again, that's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.